Hello and welcome to the Nursing Standard podcast. I'm journalist Erin Dean and today I am thrilled to be joined by Dame Claire Birchinger, a nurse whose international work pushed her into the headlines and helped prompt the charity fundraiser Band-Aid. This all began in 1984 when BBC News brought the horrors of the Ethiopian drought to a global audience. Journalist Michael Burke described the biblical famine he was witnessing as the closest thing to hell on earth. Thousands of people had already died and 7 million were threatened with starvation in the war-torn country. Among those featured was Red Cross nurse Dame Claire, who was shown having to choose which of the starving children would be saved that day due to the limited resources available. These scenes prompted musicians to launch Band-Aid and the recording of charity single Do They Know It's Christmas. As the 40th anniversary of the BBC broadcast approaches, Dame Claire kindly joins me to look back on her experience in Ethiopia and what came after. She has had an illustrious nursing career, including being assistant professor at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine for more than 25 years. Here she trained other medical professionals to work in low to middle income countries. Welcome to the podcast, Dame Claire, and thanks so much for joining me today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for asking me.
So Band-Aid and Live Aid were huge cultural events in the 1980s, but let's rewind a bit and start with how you came to be in Ethiopia at that point in 1984. What had your nursing journey been, and had you always wanted to work in that area for an international aid charity?
I'd always wanted to be a nurse, ever since I was a child. And so I trained, and I always wanted to work abroad. I can remember many years ago, they used to put little envelopes through the door for collecting money. And one of them was for Biafra famine. And I can remember seeing the little pictures of the babies on the front, thinking, and I'd like to work. I want to work in Africa and help children like that prevent famine and help them live a better life. So I became a nurse. I specialised in accident emergency. I did tropical nursing as well as a part-time diploma. And then I went on to work on Expedition Operation Drake, which is the forerunner of Rally International, and it was run by the Scientific Exploration Society. And I was in Panama, Papua New Guinea and Sulawesi in Indonesia with them, working in the tropical rainforest, sleeping in hammocks, living in the jungle, getting water from the river, cooking over wood fires, 100% humidity. I loved it. I did that for a year and a half. And then I was assistant accident emergency at Leeds General Hospital. And then I was ready to go abroad again. And I joined the International Committee of the Red Cross. I've got dual nationality, and they are the Swiss-based Red Cross that specialises in war zones. So they are the guardian of the Geneva Conventions and international humanitarian law. I spent a year in Lebanon before going to Ethiopia. And then after Lebanon, they had the Shouf Mountain wars there, I was asked to go to Ethiopia and I was delighted.
So you had a huge amount of experience by that point, a real range of experience, both in the UK and overseas. How old were you at that point in 1984 when you got to Ethiopia?
I was 31.
And I watched the original BBC broadcasts and they are utterly harrowing. Michael Burke talks about how someone was dying every 20 minutes in the camp in northern Ethiopia. So when you arrived there, what was going on and what were you tasked to do?
It was horrendous. There was just thousands of people starving, hungry, wearing tatters, clothes, not even clothes, just rags, milling around. There was insufficient food for everybody. At that time, the feeding centre I went to support had 300 children that we fed three times a day. It built up to over 1,000, but it slowly over the months. And it was the most horrendous thing you can imagine. I mean, I can remember one day having to select. We had places for 60 or 70 children. When I say places, because we didn't have sufficient food to feed more. And so I went out to select these children. And I remember counting 10 rows of children. And in each row, there was over 100 children. That's 1,000 children. They were all malnourished, just skin and bones, their skin dripping off their bones, no muscle, no fat left. It was just a horrendous situation to be in.
So just huge numbers of people in need.
I have to explain to you. So the feeding centre, we had one tap for running water. We had to get wood, which was brought in by donkey, to boil the water. And we gave the children a high energy milk drink at the time, which was butter oil, dried skim milk, and water. So, and oil, of course, butter oil, dried skim milk and oil to make it a high energy milk drink, because they couldn't eat a proper diet. They were so malnourished. We didn't have the right equipment or staff to give them advanced intravenous infusions and rehydration. So I took the ones, I had to take the ones which were, had a sort of a glint of spark of life in their eyes, because the ones that were too bad, gone, as soon as they started drinking, they would die. Their body couldn't take any type of food straight away. I knew those that I turned away would die within the next week, 10 days. It was that bad. But I was so busy. You're so busy feeding that 500, which you'd made up to after a couple of months, 500 children, that you just can't think straight to think too much about those you couldn't help.
Yeah, how did you find it day to day? It was obviously, as you say, you're incredibly busy and working in very difficult circumstances. Mm. How did you find it?
Well, remember I'd worked in living in the jungle. So I lived in a hotel. It's called the Castle Hotel in Mekelle. It had no running water, it had no electricity. They used to make a wood fire on the floor in the kitchens. The water was brought in by women carrying it on their backs through great big gourds and put in a bucket for us to wash. Light was by candles at night. And our food, we had food, basic food, tinned food, dried food, rice and things like that. So I had a reasonably basic ration. And as I say, I found it challenging, to say the least, but you were so busy. Couldn't think too much.
And what are there any memories that are particularly acute or vivid from that time? Any days or any events that particularly have stayed with you over the 40 years that have passed since?
Oh, so many. I do remember one day I was in the feeding centre and I was with my field officer at SMADA, and we saw this woman in the distance about 200 metres away walking towards us, and she had something carrying in her arms, and she was kicking something on the ground which was moving forward. And we thought it was probably a chicken or a goat or something like that. And then all of a sudden she gave an almost extra kick to this thing on the ground and whack, gave it a whack. And we saw this head appear, and this head was full of teeth and started screaming back at her, and she was screaming at it and kicking it. We realised it was a child. But when I say it's full of mouth full of teeth, I thought, well, it shouldn't be crawling, it should be walking. So we ran over to her and said, what are you doing? Why are you kicking your child? You mustn't do that. And she told us her story. She'd been walking now for 2 weeks at least. She'd had nothing, no proper food. They just had grasses and anything that they could pick around from bushes, but there wasn't much around because it was a drought. Water they got from puddles. And this was Kiros, her son, on the ground, and she was carrying her newborn baby in her arms. Her husband had been taken by the war, and all our other children had died. So I do remember that really harrowing. I mean, there's so many events that I remember. The death of the children, how they were wrapped in flour sacks at night. First thing in the morning, they had a trumpet that blew when there was a death, and people used to parade down to outside of the town to bury the children and the people, and yeah, all those things, so much. Anyway, just to tell you that Kiros came into the feeding centre, and I can remember a couple of weeks later him waving at me on his matchstick legs as I came into the feeding centre, and he made a good recovery.
Ah, that is good to hear. When you got your place, when you found got your placement there and found out you were going there, did you expect, were you prepared for what you were going to experience? Did you expect it to see such a depth of suffering?
I had no idea what I was going to see. I'd never seen anything like it before. So it was, everything was new. Everything was new. And you just thrown in from day one, just start, you know, up and running straight away.
And how long were you there?
I was there for a year.
And at what point did the BBC and Michael Burke from the BBC, at what point did they turn up to do some filming? And what can you remember about that?
I can remember, now they must have, about 4 or 5 months. About 4 or 5 months after I'd been there, you have to remember it was a communist regime. They didn't allow foreigners to come in to the area that I was in, the Tigray province. And when I say foreigners, it's even people from other villages or their own Ethiopians. People were not meant to travel at all. And the BBC managed to catch a lift with a charity in their small lightweight aeroplane. And they just turned up at the side of the feeding centre, which was made of corrugated iron around the edge. And I can remember there was this man who was obviously Michael Burke, and this Mo Amin, the cameraman, carrying this great big camera on his shoulders. And as far as I was concerned, they got in the way because I was trying to feed all these children. We gave, at that time, we'd given 5 meals a day, and they were screaming and they're vomiting, and some got diarrhea, and you're trying to encourage them and talk to the parents and everything. And all the film men wanted to get some really good shots, and we'd stand over here, Claire, and you carry that, perhaps have this child here and that. And I just, you know, it was, they got in the way, and I couldn't get rid of them fast enough. And I had no idea about how it affected the world when the film did go out.
So was it something that you didn't give much thought to at the time? As you say, they were just a bit of a hindrance in a busy day where you were focused on the people you were caring for.
So you just did it
and they left, and that was at that point the last you thought about it.
You've got to remember in 84, we didn't have telephones, remember, mobile or landlines. We didn't have television or internet. Communications with the outside world I did with a letter, which could take several weeks to get to Europe, if at all. We only had one plane, it's a national plane, Ethiopian Airlines, who came once a week. So I wasn't really aware of what was happening outside.
And when did you first pick up on the fact that quite a lot was happening after the broadcasts had gone out?
Well, I do remember hearing on my shortwave radio, which sort of comes and goes, I remember hearing this song, Feed the World, Do They Know It's Christmas, by this guy called Bob Geldof. No idea who that was. And they were raising money for Ethiopia. And I thought, well, they need more than a bloody band-aid here. And no, they don't know it's Christmas, because in Ethiopia have the completely different calendar, and so it's not Christmas for them. But I didn't quite hear clearly what was happening until we started getting these great big Hercules C-130 aeroplanes arriving with food. And they said that they had, the crew members, they were different from all different countries of the world, many military, and they said they'd seen the film. And so they explained to me why. And from one plane a week, we got several a day, and the food started coming in. Wow.
Did it make a difference then to you tremendous. At that point?
Mm. Oh, for goodness sake, yes, absolutely. And then we started, we could feed the people. We got many more children to feed. Other aid organisations started to be able to allowed in and set up other feeding centres. I was moved to a different area down in the valley, a place called Maicho, to set up another new feeding centre. So it made a tremendous difference. It was amazing, wonderful.
Oh, so it did make that quite rapid difference on the ground then, with the kind of equipment and food that started arriving. And as you say, just by casting a light on what was happening and raising awareness, it brought other charities as well into the area.
Yeah.
And so what, you said you stayed there a year. What happened then? Were you due to move on to somewhere else?
I decided that I needed to learn a bit more French. I need to be a bit more fluent in French, because the International Committee of the Red Cross is based in Switzerland. So their main languages are German and French, although English as well. So I decided to go and work in Switzerland and improve my French. And I worked at a place called Sion in the Valais region of Switzerland. And I chose it because it was nearest to the ski slopes. And so work was in accident emergency, and my time off, I was in the mountains either skiing or walking. It was one, so it was a great change. I also had a cousin who had a chalet at 2,000 meters high. It was an old cow shed. I mean, it was still a cow shed. It was pretty bad. It didn't have running water or electricity, but that didn't bother me. And I spent a lot of days up in the mountains, just by myself and listening to the birds, the cows, looking at flowers, so to speak.
Yeah, I was going to ask, after spending a year working in such a challenging, that word seems quite inadequate, but challenging situation, did you need to leave at that point, do you think, and to go away and restore a bit?
I didn't think that at the time, no. I needed to learn French. That's what I went there for. And so I learned French.
And when you look back and reflect on the year in Ethiopia, what do you think you learnt? What are the particularly key things that you learnt from there, and how did it influence your practice later?
I think there's so much need in the world, and there's so little focus on what is really important. Affecting my practice, I think, because it was fighting, it was internal conflict as well as a communist regime, and I just couldn't get over that this fighting, this war, it's so wrong, and there's no winners in war ever, and there had to be an alternative to war, and that sort of took me on a journey of seeking in this world of plenty why there's so few people have nothing and so many have so much, too much, because there is sufficient in the world. And in the end, believe it or not, the thing that did give me the best hope in the world is I found Buddhism. I became a Buddhist, and I'm a member of the Soka Gakkai International, which its core principle is respect for dignity of human life and interconnectedness of yourself and the environment. And that's what really helped me move on. And of course, affecting my, as you said, but how did it affect your work? It affected my work, and as I had more sense in what I was doing, more meaning what I was doing. And I continued to work for the International Committee of the Red Cross in many other war zones after that.
Mm-hmm. And getting back to the Band Aid and the concert Live Aid, fame is not something that most nurses expect, and I'm sure that you didn't, but your work in Ethiopia did push you into the spotlight. How have you found being well known? Has it been a strange thing? Have you been able to use it constructively through your career?
I don't see myself having fame, but I do see if, for instance, having this interview is it's a tool. Tool to create value in the world, and if anything, to show people to tell people or to encourage people to be the change that they wish to see. So if I give an interview or talk about it, it's prevent all this suffering and war, and let's find an alternative, transcend our differences and make humanity our highest priority in life, not economics.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think how international aid charities work in foreign countries has probably changed a lot over the last 40 years. Mm-hmm. And I just wondered how you feel about Band-Aid and its legacy now. It was brilliant to hear that you saw it make an immediate difference on the ground. But then there have also been some suggestions that it reinforced some negative tropes about Africa. How do you feel about it now, looking back on it with the time that has passed?
So at the time, it was exactly what was needed. And Bob Geldof did what he could do to help. If he hadn't have done it, I don't know what would have happened. If he hadn't have raised the profile, because him raising the profile in Britain suddenly raised the profile in America and all other countries of the world. Remember, it was transmitted all around the world when it happened. So it made a tremendous difference. Nowadays, we are more aware of decolonizing global health, and we are more aware of helping people to help themselves. At the time, because the International Committee of the Red Cross is quite unique, it's usually necessary to have somebody who's neutral to go into certain areas of the world to help in conflict situations. But other organisations nowadays are using a lot more local nurses and doctors to continue the work or not necessarily voluntary. They can be paid a certain amount because you need professional people. You can't always be a volunteer because most people have got a family to look after. But there's plenty of professional people in the world, in the indigenous population that's affected, that can help. And that's empowering the population, refugees, displaced people. There'll be nurses, doctors, teachers, lawyers, you name it, among the displaced people. They're not helpless, so encourage them, support them to help themselves. And that's very important. And international organisations realise that now. And so they will focus more on that rather than outsiders coming in.
So that's quite a change that's happened over those four decades, isn't it? A shift to building within a community, building on its strengths.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's a big shift. We're still learning how to do it. Remember, it's going to take a long time but we're moving forward in the right direction, I believe.
And awareness of the impact of trauma on healthcare professionals, you know, that could be in this country or somewhere else, is much better now, I think, or growing. And you in Ethiopia, and I'm sure elsewhere, saw a lot of suffering on a very big scale. You spoke about how you felt you were having to choose which children would live and which wouldn't. We touched on it before when you spoke about Buddhism, but how did what you've witnessed through your career affect you, and how have you coped with it?
Again, I've coped with it as best I can. I was fortunate to have psychological support at the time. The thing is, once you've been through any event in your life, will change you. You know, whether it's a car accident or a miscarriage it will change you. It changed your life. So yes, this is no different. It changes me in my life, my view. I can remember coming back from, I was in Afghanistan for years. Well, I remember coming back from Afghanistan and just walking along the road, a little lane where I used to live with my dog, and being scared to walk being very aware not to walk on the grass, because in the past it might have been mined, so you mustn't walk on the grass. And then also coming back from Ethiopia, eating a crisp apple and running water. Even now, I don't flush the loo every time I have a pee, because I think, oh, that water, it's good water. You know, that's clean water, believe it or not. It's the same water that you drink from the tap that that flushes the loo. And I think, well, I don't want to waste water, you know, it's to do with sustainable development and looking after the environment. So I wouldn't necessarily even now flush the loo every time I have a pee. It's wasteful. And I remember also Afghanistan coming back, I used to get up at night. I used to live near Stansted Airport and I used to get up at night when I heard the certain planes taking off. And I said, just look out and check it wasn't a Scud missile that was flying across. Mm. It's a laugh now, but I knew I was home, but I just had to check.
So you live with the things you've experienced over over the decades, and incorporated that into your life now still. And in the past 40 years, you've amassed an incredible number of honours and recognition. In 2009, you became a Dame Commander of British Empire for services to nursing and to international humanitarian aid. What have you learnt about the importance of inspirational nursing leaders? You know, what difference can strong leaders, especially women such as yourself, make in nursing?
There's many strong leaders. There's also many strong then not really leaders, it's the ordinary person that can change the world. And as I mentioned before, we have to be the change we wish to see. The problem in many countries, in all over the world, is the lack of nurses, the lack of healthcare, trained healthcare professionals. That's the big problem at the moment. So we have we need more nurses. If you imagine in the world, I think there's about 80% of women are people. 80% of nurses are the healthcare. You know, most countries don't have doctors or they have very minimal. And so it's healthcare, it falls on nurses. So we have to be the change we wish to see and do our best and report back when we are unable to do our best. And just keep making reports, telling people the truth, and talking about it.
Mm. And for nurses who might be listening and who might think, I would love to do some work in a low to middle income country. What advice would you have for them? What would be a good way to make it happen, to put them in a good place for it?
Yeah. Well, it's not necessary that they need to go themselves, but I would say they must educate themselves. So it's no good being a nurse here in Britain and thinking going to work in a resourceful situation where you won't not necessarily have running water, electricity or drugs or even a blood pressure machine. So prepare yourself. You can prepare yourself by doing a diploma in tropical nursing at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. It's a part-time course, one day a week. So you can do it when you're working full-time. You can get a day off and the lectures are recorded as well. And then once you've done that, the way forward in nursing nowadays is actually you need to go on forward and get a master's degree, because the only way that you're going to be listened to by other healthcare professionals is research-based evidence. So I encourage all my nurses from the tropical nursing course that I've been teaching on to go on and do a master's degree. And then they learn a lot more detail about doing research-based evidence about why you're doing what you're doing. I think that's the main thing. I mean, because there's so many other things. I mean, you think about getting them used to having challenging situations and getting used to volunteering as well, which could be working with a charity in their own country, whether it's Britain or Ireland or Germany or wherever, or America. It could be working with drug addicts or the homeless or perhaps old people or children, less vantage children, so that they're used to working and thinking outside the box.
But that education is absolutely key from what you're saying, for having that educational foundation. And looking back now, what are you most proud of in your career, Dame Claire?
Well, actually, I think what I'm not sure the word is proud, but the most thing that gives me most pleasure is in when my mother was 83, my father died, And I decided to move house, give up, sell my place and move back and look after her. And I was with her for nearly 10 years. I looked after her. She was blind and deaf and had arthritis and in a chair, and she got cancer. And I would say that was one of the most happiest times of my life. It was something I've never thought I would do. My parents never asked us. They always said, oh, no, you just go off and have your own life. We can look after ourselves. But it was something I just really felt necessary. It's just sort of organically happened. And I, with my Buddhist practice, it felt the right thing to do. And I would say that was the best time.
Oh, well, thank you so much. Thank you for sharing so much of your incredible career and your memories, both professional and personal there. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
No, thank you for inviting me. Thank you very much.